to Comic Talk Today for Monday, July 30th, 2018. And this is the Top of the Pile, the episode of the week in which I talk about some of my favorite reads from last week's New Comic Book Day. And this week, I've got 8 titles. We've got 1 Image, 3 Marvel, 1 Boom, and 3 DC. And of course, at the end of the episode, I've decided to make some scheduling changes, so I'll be doing the Comic Predictor at the end of the Top of the Pile segment on Mondays now instead of on Tuesday. I figure that'll give everybody a little bit extra time to get their ducks in a row and figure out what they're going to purchase for New Comic Book Day. Before we kick off the show, I want to make sure that everyone knows that we have a new podcast on the network. You can check out Missouri Swagger with writer Cullen Bunn and writer Dennis Hopeless. And they started a YouTube channel and will be hosting the audio version of their podcast on the network. So be sure to head on over to nerdlegion.com/podcast/Missouri Swagger and you can find out how to listen to those episodes. It's not on iTunes or anything yet, but it should be by today or tomorrow, I would assume. So stay tuned for that. I'll make an announcement on Twitter. Now, without further ado, it is time for the Top of the Pile. And I want to kick things off with the Image title, and this is The New World, #1. And I'm surprised I picked this, but I really, really enjoyed it. Written by Alish Kott, with art by Trad Moore, colors by Heather Moore, letters by Clayton Cowell. Now, if you've been following my podcasting for the last couple of years, you may be very well aware that I'm not generally a big fan of Alish Kott's work. And I think part of that has to do with how jaded I became when he wrote The Dead Hand for Valiant. It was probably one of my favorite books of the year when that came out. So I've been kind of averse to trying out some new Alish Kott books. But I gotta say, I really enjoyed this book. It is a little political, so if you are not into that, you may not enjoy this. However, I think the politics in this book is very much a center of what the story is about. And to give you a little heads up on the plot of the story, this takes place in the not-so-distant future, a few decades into the future, where there's been a major disaster. There was wars all over the country. We can assume World War III, or all over the world, excuse me. There was a civil war in the United States, and pretty much the story focuses on the U.S., even though we get to see a little bit about what's going on in the rest of the world at the beginning of the issue. And the United States has been torn apart, and there's a few different territories that were created as a result. So on the East Coast, we've got, on the Northeast, the United States of East Americas. On the Southeast, we have the Union of Federations. On the West Coast, we have New California, which looks like it encompasses California, and then all the states on the border going down to Texas. And then everything else is part of No Man's Land, which I found interesting that it's called No Man's Land because there were 5 nuclear detonations around the country, and they were pretty much interspersed around the country. So it's not like they were all in this one place, but I thought that was pretty interesting. I guess it kind of does make sense, though, because given the population of the United States, a large chunk of the center, I would say, is kind of empty-ish. And if you're listening to this from one of those states, then I apologize. But, you know, like Montana, those kind of places, their population is very sparse. So I can totally see that. And, you know, this is not something new. I think every time we have some strong sci-fi, you always see kind of the middle of the country be kind of like a battle zone or a no man's land. So I wasn't surprised by that. This book does take place in New California, though. It doesn't really discuss much about the other quote-unquote states, I guess countries at this point, of the ex-United States. But it deals with New California, and their president I thought was hilarious because he looks just like Colonel Sanders from KFC, except a little more futuristic hairstyle, but you can imagine what I'm talking about. If you are a fan of Aeon Flux, for those of you that are a little bit older may remember Aeon Flux was a cartoon on MTV back when MTV had actual TV shows and not just reality TV. Of course, after they played music because it's no longer music television. Anyways, so the styling of this book is very similar to Aeon Flux, I would say. So if you enjoy that, I think you'll probably definitely enjoy checking this book out. It's similar in tone and nature. And so we focus on New California, and pretty much there's no more sports. There's only one sport. And I thought it was interesting because it's a massive extrapolation, hyperbole even, of kind of the type of reality shows that we see now. And the one sport is kind of a televised reality show version of, I guess we could say, maybe Cops. So there are certain cops that are sent out. They're more like bounty hunters than actual cops. So in some ways, it's kind of like a mix of Aeon Flux and Judge Dredd. So this may be the reason why I enjoy this book so much, because I love both of those properties, in particular Judge Dredd. And basically, the hunt that they go on for killers is televised. And, well, it's not always killers, but it is criminals. And there's a couple of different ones that are extremely popular, and we do focus on those. And the main character is actually related to the president of New California. It's actually the president's granddaughter. And she is very different from him and from what society expects. And that's established pretty early on in the story. She goes to get this criminal. She catches the guy. And before she can decide what they're going to do with the guy, there's a vote. So everybody that's watching the TV show votes on whether the guy should be arrested or killed. And based on those actions, the cops react. And her thing is she does not want to kill. And this is not a spoiler. It's established pretty early in the story. She doesn't want to kill. And so even when the vote is in favor of executing the criminal on the spot, she does not do it. And it causes some issues between her and her grandfather, who's the president, because, of course, he has a certain, you know, he has to guide the society in a certain way. And the fact that she doesn't abide by those rules all the time kind of disappoints him in some way. But he's kind of okay with it because she's extremely popular. And these people make a bunch of money. They're famous. Everybody recognizes them. Throughout the series, we learn that after one of these hunts, there's a party. And she goes to the party, meets up with one of the other cops, and they end up having sex. And it's not really graphic. It's only one panel. And I don't think there's any nudity shown, if I remember correctly. But that kind of sets up where the story will be going, because the president finds out about this and sends her and the number one cop on the hunt for this third cop, because she doesn't want her with him. Makes sense, I guess. That's pretty much the overall thing of the story. Kind of pretty simple. Nothing really new and innovative here, although I did enjoy it quite a bit. And, you know, even though I've seen this kind of story before, it's not something that's played around with quite often. So I enjoyed that Image is doing this kind of book. And, of course, it is very post-apocalyptic, so I do enjoy that kind of thing. I think the strongest part of this book, though, is the art. And I'm not too familiar with Trad Moore. I'm sure some of the listeners of this podcast might be. But I really love the style. It's sort of manga-esque, but not really. It's almost like a mix of different styles. There's a little manga in here. There's a little bit of European inspiration to the art. I really, really enjoyed it. I think a lot of that has to do with the color choices. The colors are very bold and very vibrant, and it shows kind of in the story. So I really, really dug this one. I'm definitely going to be sticking with the New World. I know I had it on the Comic Predictor when I talked about it last week, and I'm glad that I really dug the book, because I was a little concerned based on my past history with the writer. But, you know, based on this book, I'm going to stick with it, and I look forward to seeing what else he has to bring. Overall, I've had to rate this book. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5. I really, really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. And it might not be your cup of tea, but at least, you know, take a look at some preview pages or look at some reviews and see what you think if you decided not to purchase this book. Real quick, let's go over to Marvel. And two, I'm going to do very, very quick. So quickly, I wanted to talk about X-Men Grand Design, Second Genesis, number one. This is written, colored, illustrated, inked, cover by Ed Pisker. He does everything. And of course, this is volume two of X-Men Grand Design. Volume one came out last year, if I'm not mistaken, and there were two issues. I'm not sure how much this one is. I'm going to assume it's also going to be two issues. And if you're not aware what X-Men Grand Design is, it's basically a retelling of the entire history of the X-Men in comic book format. And I find that so fascinating. So fascinating. For one, let me talk about the art. The art is gorgeous. It's a mix of like early Silver Age, maybe late Golden Age artwork, and it's beautiful. And the way that the pages are done, there's like a patina to the coloring. It's very muted, very much emulating that Silver Age look. And I love that. I love that. It works so well for this kind of story. Everything's very much a throwback, right? Because we're retelling the story of the X-Men. So it's the old costume designs, the old logo designs. It's just incredible. And I think the language is done very well to kind of emulate how the language was laid out in those comics in the 70s and 80s. So really, really dug it. Volume 1 pretty much was concerned just with the original X-Men team. This one actually kicks off, I don't even know what year it was, I should have looked it up, but I guess with Giant Size X-Men number one. So this is when we had the new team come on board. So you no longer had, you know, Jean Grey and all those people. You had, Colossus and Storm and Nightcrawler, Wolverine, as lead members of the X-Men team. And so it kicks off with that story. Goes through and talks about the Hellfire Club, which of course I love. So Emma Frost is in here. Automatically, that's a win for me. And, the book ends up roughly around the era of the Dark Phoenix saga, which, is a very convoluted era. And I'm glad that this book is going to be tackling it. So the reason I wanted to recommend this book is if you are an X-Men fan, this is definitely worth you getting. Definitely worth you getting. If you've never read an X-Men book, this is worth you getting. And the reason for that is it's almost like an encyclopedia. It's like a Cliff Notes version of X-Men history. And the X-Men have such a long and convoluted history that it's really nice to see this kind of pared down, minimalist version of that story with just absolutely beautiful art. I mean, this thing is so well put together. And I know the schedule for the first volume of this was a little odd, and I hope that it's not the case for this one. But I can really understand why, because Pisker does everything by himself, and of course he has to read every single one of these books in order to make a cohesive story that lasts two or three issues. And that's just incredible, an incredible achievement. So I cannot recommend X-Men Grand Design, Second Genesis enough. I think it's a brilliant book, something that nobody I think has really done before this came out last year, and now with this second volume. And I highly, highly recommend it. I know some of you that have been reading comics for, you know, 30, 40 years will definitely love this thing. And, for those of you that are new, that want to see what comics were like back then, with kind of a little bit of a modern sensibility added in, very, very much recommend this. So I'm going to give this one a 4 out of 5 as well. Real quickly on Moon Knight number 197. This is written by Max Bemis with art by Jason Burrows, inks by Guillermo Ortega, and colors by Matt Miller, and letters by Corey Pettit. And the reason I wanted to talk about this is I recorded an episode of the Ultimate Marvel Podcast with Ronnie yesterday as of the time of this recording. I think it comes out the same day as this episode does. So go on over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast and check out the latest episode of the Ultimate Marvel Podcast, which you should be subscribed to anyway. But I talked a little bit about Moon Knight because Moon Knight is one of my favorite, if not my favorite Marvel character. It's definitely up there, definitely top 5. I own basically every single Moon Knight comic, every single Moon Knight appearance that ever come out. I'm only missing one, and that's the first appearance in Werewolf by Night 32, and I'll probably never get that because that thing skyrocketed in price. Regardless, when this book relaunched, I really enjoyed it. I loved that first arc, and I thought it worked really well for me. It was trying something new while paying homage to the stuff that Marvel has done recently with Moon Knight and paying homage to, I mean, the long-running history of Moon Knight in itself. Moon Knight's had, I don't know what volume this is, but there's been at least like 5 or 6 volumes if we count miniseries. So I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a nice fresh take because my thing was, you know, we had Ellis go in there Jeff Lemire took over the book, and it was kind of that like Moon Knight crazy guy thing where they explore the multiple personalities. And that is an aspect here, but I want to see Moon Knight doing like cool Moon Knight stuff, you know, going out and fighting crime, getting involved with things. And I think this new iteration of the book did that to begin with, but that excitement kind of waned off for me. And I thought the story kind of started to drag a little bit, but I continued reading it. And I think with this issue, it really brings it back to a place where I really enjoyed this book again. And, I don't know if it's because, Burroughs came back to the book. He was off of it for a little bit and now he's back. And for those of you that don't know the name, he did The Crossed for Avatar Press for quite a long time. So it's that similar art style to that. And Max Bemis writes this book very much like an indie book, which I really, really like. You know, I often talk about the fact that Marvel's doing a fantastic job of bringing in indie writers and bringing that indie sensibility to their books. And I think that's never been truer than now. You know, it's a long-standing tradition, but I think right now the level of indie writers that are working at Marvel and that are no longer indie writers because now they're big two writers, it's just incredible. Some really talented folks there, and you know, this is no exception. This story is a little odd. It deals with this group of sadists who are basically, it's just super rich people who have, you know, gain money through whatever their career is. And they're asked to join this cult of sadists. And so they're having a dinner, and each of the characters that show up to this dinner that have been invited to join, they're not part of the sadist club yet, but they're invited to join, kind of tells their story. And after the last person tells his story, by the way, they're not as bad as you might think, because remember, this is still a Marvel book. Had this been done, if there was like a Marvel Max line, right? Or if they were still doing, well, maybe not Marvel Knights, but let's just do, let's say Marvel Max. If they were doing the Max line still and this was part of that, or if this was a book for another publisher, let's just say like Avatar or Black Mask or Vault or Aftershock or somebody, it definitely could have gone extremely dark very, very quickly. But, you know, there's things that you cannot do at Marvel. So as a result, it is toned down a little bit. But you do see some of the grotesque, heinous acts that some of these people do in order to have been kind of made aware of by this cult. And it's pretty interesting read. However, there will be some pretty graphic violence, so be aware if you're not reading this. As it turns out, though, one of the servers at this cult meeting ends up being Moon Knight. He's like, oh, I want to join your club. He's like, I'm a sadist. I love killing people. And there's a fight between him and the other waiters and these people that are trying to join. And then we learn, even though we see kind of bits and pieces of him throughout the issue, we learn who the mastermind, the leader of this cult is. And it's his uncle that we saw in the first arc. And I thought that was a nice comeback to that, right? Because the uncle was a really weird character. He was like a ex-Nazi who's now posing as a priest. And now we see that, you know, he definitely has some sadistic inclinations. And it made sense based on what we learned about him in that first arc. So I really enjoy the callback to that. You know, there's a little bit of humor thrown in here. You know, when Moon Knight takes off his cowl and reveals that he's not just a waiter, he's Moon Knight, there's some pretty funny lines in there. So I really enjoyed it. And the art is fantastic. So Moon Knight 197. I'm also going to give this one a 4 out of 5. I am back into this book, and I'm very excited that I'm reading it again. At least regularly. It's not like I wasn't reading it, but I'm excited to read it again. So that's pretty exciting. I didn't have it on my list, but let me throw in here Multiple Man number 2, which also came out. And I think that book is so fantastic. The second issue was more of what I hoped the first issue would go into, and that's the time travel stuff. And we see Jamie kind of go into the near future with these Jamie Avenger amalgam creature things. I don't, it's weird. Just read the book. And, we see that in the future, there's kind of a Jamie Madrox that's the dictator of the United States, and everyone's afraid of him. But, he finds Layla, his, you know, soon to be wife. He finds, his kid from the future who leads the resistance. And it's actually really funny because they go to the basement and it says resistance on the wall. And I mean, it's just the kind of writing I think that Rosenberg does, and I think does really well. The book is very comedic, but it's not kind of off the wall, and because I hate off the wall, and I don't hate this book. In fact, I really enjoy this book. I think it's a lot of fun, and I understand that some people don't like the this new take on Jamie Madrox, but you got to remember, it's not the Jamie you know, right? This is one of his multiples. So I'm really digging it. This book is a lot of fun. It's a great palate cleanser when you read some really hard-hitting, tough books, and I cannot recommend it enough. So really enjoyed Multiple Man number 2. Over to Boom Studios. Let's talk about Bone Parish. This is written by Cullen Bunn. We've got art by Jonas Scharf, colors by Alex Gomez, and letters by Ed Dukeshire. Oh, and the cover by Lee Garbett is fantastic. I can't talk about this cover enough. I love it. And, you know, I had Cullen on last week. We talked about the book just a little bit. I recommended it again last week as well for the Comic Predictor, and I finally can talk about this. I love this book so much. This may be one of the strongest first issues, I think, that Cullen Bunn has ever written, at least in recent memory. And maybe the only one that inches ahead for me is probably Harrow County, because I think Harrow County is a little bit darker. This book, while there are definite horror elements, it's a lot more like a crime story, and a very personal crime story, which I was very surprised about. So I expected the horror elements, and if you did listen to the interview, go check it out. But this book is basically about a family that has found a way to create a drug out of the bones of dead people. I mean, technically, I guess they could use just any dead person, but part of the reason people really like this drug is it causes you to hallucinate. And when you hallucinate, you kind of relive the life of whoever's bones you just ingested in that drug, right? So, you know, when the book kicks off, we see a musician and there's a guy that took the drug and it obviously took way too much of the drug and has very intense hallucinations and he's reliving this concert experience. And I'm sure it's amazing, right? Like, I don't often feel this way, but you know, I love analyzing how people work. And so I often try to put myself in the shoes of somebody else to see, like, what kind of life would I lead as this person, right? And I think part of that is kind of the writer in me. And, you know, I was an English major, so I did a ton of writing, a ton of reading. And that's why I love characters and why I love comics and why I love really good comics with good characterization. And this book does that so, so well. This family is basically the kids go out at night and they dig up bones of people at per request, right? So there may be poets or philosophers or artists or musicians or I guess some people might want like a snort a politician. I don't know. Maybe. But, so we learn a lot about the dynamic of the siblings. We learn about the dad and the mom is the person in charge of this whole thing. And, she's a very strong person, but at the same time, a very broken person. And I'm not going to go into details as to why, but man, the last page of this book was just freaking heart-wrenching. I really felt so bad for this character who has to be so strong because she's leading a criminal organization, but even though she's a criminal, she's still a human being, right? With feelings and emotions. And that's what I really like about this. Because a lot of times when we have villains, in particular in organized crime, in the majority of books, they're just really bad people. Really bad people. And very few times do we get to see the human side of those people. And it made me think a little bit of watching the Daredevil TV show on Netflix. And this is totally unrelated, yes. So, bear with me on the logic. When Fisk shows up in the Netflix TV show, he's kind of a tough dude, right? Like we know from the comics, he's just a tough dude. He does bad things. He doesn't really give two craps. You know, he's the man. But we learn in that series about his love for this woman and how that affects him and how that kind of drives him to do what he does and do it a certain way because he wants to create a family with this person and be the best he can be. And it doesn't work out that way, but it really gave Fisk kind of a very human side that I don't often see in comics, right? And I mean, I don't read enough Daredevil and anything really with Wilson Fisk, so I'm sure I've missed many a story, but I just love that personality, right? Because a lot of times these comic book characters are really cartoonish, right? And you don't see that other side of them. You know, you might have a writer that's a really good writer and try to tell those kind of stories, but it doesn't happen very often, right? You might see them like every, I don't know, 50 issues that they show up or something. But like, just to kick this off, learning about how this whole criminal organization works and to see the trauma that this woman's gone through and why she does the things that she does and to learn that a character that was a key part of the story may not be what he appears to be, I thought was just brilliant. I mean, this issue is really, really strong. Bone Parish, I mean, I can't recommend it enough. It right now it's a toss up. I'm still tied, between two different books. The next one I'm going to talk about next, as for pick of the week. I mean, this is a 5 out of 5, just absolutely brilliant. And the art, sweet Jesus. I mean, the book is beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And, I really enjoy this. You know, I was a little sad when Harrow County ended a couple of weeks ago, but you know, Colin's always writing stuff and I think this book is kind of what's going to replace that for me. I loved every single detail about this book and I can't recommend it enough. I know this book was originally planned as a shorter run and based on the interest of retailers and fans, Boom has extended this to a 12 issue series. I hope the interest continues and this book can continue well beyond that because one thing that Cullen Bunn really excels at is telling long-term stories and I think 12 issues is a good place to start, but you know, this book could easily go you know, 50 issues, 100 issues. And I would love to see that because this world is so fascinating. And I can't wait to read more. So 5 out of 5 for Bone Parish. Just pick this one up. I don't think you'll be disappointed. The other 5 out of 5 book, there I spoiled the score. Sorry, folks. For me, at least, is going to be Venom number 4. And man, I talk about this book like all the damn time. The other day I read this book and immediately I went to our Discord chat where all the other Nerdy Legion podcasters hang out. And I was like, who has read Venom? I need to talk about this. And I thought it was brilliant. And I don't want to spoil anything because this is very much a spoiler full issue. We learn all about the Null. We learn where he comes from, who he is. We learn so much about the symbiotes and all the stuff everyone says is being retconned. I gotta tell you, I don't care if it's being retconned. I think the stuff that we see in this issue is brilliant. Brilliant. We have a new way of seeing what it means to be a Clintar, and Clintar is the race of the symbiotes, and what the word means. We learn about the connection between the Vikings and this, and the Null, and why he's inhabited this body. We learn that this character is involved and connected to Thor, which I thought was brilliant as well, because he creates a Necrosaur that Gore uses to fight Thor, and that was in God of Thunder, so 2011, 2012, 2013. I don't even remember what issue it was. It was pretty early on. But just absolutely brilliant. I loved all the connections that Donny Cates made this. Oh, I should probably say that. Donny Cates wrote it. Pencils by Ryan Stegman. We got inks by J.P. Mayer. Colors by Frank Martin. And letters by Clayton Cowles. Just, it's fantastic. And I love the art. I mean, Stegman is on point with this thing. I love the new symbiote designs. I love how swirly and crazy all the panels are. It's just a fantastic book. And this is a stealth horror book. I mean, this is a horror book. Okay. You cannot deny it. And I think that may be part of the problem that people have is that Donnie is taking a superhero story and turning it into a horror book. And maybe some people don't want that, but I love that. And this book really works for me. I'm going to try to not talk about Venom every couple of weeks because it seems like that's exactly what the case is. But I really enjoy it, and I hope that if you are, you let me know, because I want to talk to you about it. You can find me on Twitter at Geekvine, or you can email nerdylegion@gmail.com. All right, from there, let's go on over to DC, and first up, we're going to talk about Justice League Dark number 1. This is written by James Tynion IV, with pencils by Alvaro Martinez Bueno, inks by Raul Fernandez, colors by Brad Anderson, and letters by Rob Lee. And this was an interesting issue. I think this is, to me, this very much reads like a first issue. And I know when I say that, some of you immediately think to yourself, that means you think it's bad. And that's not at all what I mean by saying that. When I say that this reads like a first issue is, there is a lot of setup in this issue. A lot of setup. We don't really know kind of what the problem is, like the real problem, but there's hints of it, right? So the book kicks off with Zatanna. She's doing a magic show, and when she tries to pull a rabbit out of a hat, the rabbit is all bloodied up, and there's this, like, octopus squiddy type thing. I mean, I don't know. There's tentacles that come out of the hat, and they start grabbing audience members out of the onto the stage and ripping them apart and this and that and the other, and she doesn't know what to do. She tries different magic spells, and none of them work. They all backfire, and they end up attacking her instead of the creature, and then a woman shows up, and she's like, let's try not using magic, And when she showed up, it really clicked for me why they chose to put Wonder Woman in this book. Because, you know, there is the mythological, mystical side of Wonder Woman. There is a little bit of magic, in particular with older iterations of Wonder Woman. But the thing about Wonder Woman is she is very much about the hand-to-hand combat. Whereas every other member of this team is not that. And for me, that worked very well because they need that kind of leadership. We see John Constantine show up in here, which, that was okay, but I think the Zatanna stuff really worked for me. I love Zatanna, and I'm super glad to see Zatanna showing up in a book again. I hope that if they end up doing some kind of turning on the team where, you know, they bring in different magical beings to help out along the way, they never get rid of Zatanna because I think she's fascinating, and I don't think she's used enough. And whatever is happening in this world with magic dying, as it seems, definitely has to do with Zatanna. And we see Zatar, her dad, who comes to her kind of in a hallucination, maybe magical dream, and explains kind of what's going on, that there's something coming, and we don't know kind of what that is. But it was really interesting. Along the way, you know, Wonder Woman tries to recruit Zatanna to joining the Justice League Dark, and Zatanna's like, look, I don't want to join your team. Like, I've got enough problems as it is. And Wonder Woman goes searching for more team members. And it's hilarious because apparently nobody wants to join this team for whatever reason. And she goes to the bar that's run by Detective Chimp. And that was awesome. Detective Chimp in here, maybe my favorite character of the book. Although I gotta say, Man-Bat was also pretty freaking awesome. And I'll get to Man-Bat in a second. She's talking to Detective Chimp at the bar, and he's like, look, he's like, I'm not doing anything. Nobody likes me because, you know, the guy that used to own the bar and had, the dagger was like this super cool dude. Everybody knew him. He was super famous. You know, everybody came to the bar. It's like, you know, a bar between dimensions, so magical beings can go there and just kind of relax. And he's like, now when I took over, they're like, oh, the stupid monkey's there. Like, we don't want to go there anymore. So it brought in some humor and it was awesome. He's like, look, you need some help. I'm a detective. They don't call me Detective Chimp for nothing. I'll go and help you figure out what's going on. So they go to the headquarters of the Justice League Dark, which really right now is nobody because it's just them. And Man-Bat's there. And apparently he's working with Argus trying to redeem himself for his past crimes. And the character design's a little quirky because he's very much got a human body, but he's got the giant bat head, and he's super smart. So Wonder Woman's using him to kind of investigate some of these grotesque, like mutated bodies that are popping out from the magical world, and trying to figure out why it is that's happening to them. And when those beings come back to life and they start attacking them, Wonder Woman's like, look, you're not scary enough as the Professor Langstrom guy, even though he's got the giant bat head. You need to do something about that. And so he takes a serum and injects himself and he goes like full-blown Man-Bat. And it was just freaking awesome. Like, Man-Bat's a cool character. And I love the take on this. He was really funny. Really funny. And I appreciated that. While all that's happening, Zatanna has gone to talk to Swamp Thing and kind of recruits him to help her figure out what's happening. And they go to the Justice League headquarters, and together they end up fighting these mutated beings. So overall, you know, pretty interesting stuff. I'm going to wait to see how this ends up developing after a couple of issues. I know there's going to be a tie-in between this book and Wonder Woman, so that should prove to be pretty interesting. I don't mind the crossovers between like two books. It's just when you get a little bit bigger that I have an issue with. But really, really dug the beginning of this. I think this book has a lot of potential, and all the characters are very interesting and very unique. And I can definitely see how they will work together. So I'm looking forward to seeing the team develop and to figure out what really the issue is with magic dying in this book. If I had to rate this book, I mean, that's a little tough. You know, like I said, to me, this reads very much like a first issue, and generally that would make me want to rate it a little bit lower. And you know, I hate doing like decimal places on scores, but I feel like I need to on this. I'm going to rate it a 3.75 out of 5. I really, really enjoyed it, but there's something missing for me. And it puts the book somewhere between like and really like, and that's why I want to rate it that way. But there's something missing right now. But I think the book has a lot of potential, and I love that DC's taking a shot with the magic books now. You know, Hellblazer just finished, so really outside of that, there's not a magic book, I don't think, over at DC. If I'm missing one, let me know. But I'm pretty sure that was the only one at the moment, and I look forward to seeing how this one is, and I hope that we get some offshoots as a result. Even if it's just one shots, I'd be okay with it. I'd love to see Detective Chimp one shot. I would love a Zatanna miniseries at least. Hopefully this book proves popular enough where some of that stuff can happen. But really, really dug it. Next up is Action Comics number 1001, written by Brian Michael Bendis, with art by Patrick Gleason, colors by Alejandro Sanchez, letters by Josh Reed. And boy, oh boy, let me tell you, Patrick Gleason has leveled up for this book. Now, that's not to say that I don't like his art. I've always loved Patrick Gleason's art, but there is something about this issue that puts it above anything that I've seen from him before. It's more polished. It's a little less cartoony. It's beautiful. I mean, there's some panels that are just gorgeous to look at. And I wonder how much of that has to do with the coloring work. I'm sure a lot of that does play into that. It looks like Patrick Gleason is inking himself in this book, so I think that may help sometimes as well. We get, as an artist, you can really get the exact style that you want when you're doing the pencils and the inks yourself. But man, like, I was really impressed with the art of this issue. Really fantastic. Some great panels. Very dynamic. The whole thing is dynamic. Even the panel layouts themselves are used very well to drive the story forward. And this kind of goes off kind of after the events of the Superman issue that came out, I guess, last week or 2 weeks ago. And so there's definitely some relation in the story here to that. So I really recommend probably reading both of these books together. I know sometimes people have a tough time picking up extra books, but, you know, from the beginning, Bendis said that this would be kind of an intertwined story. And there's going to be different takes on the stories depending on what book we're in, right? Whereas Superman will concentrate more on the Superman aspect of the character. Action will concentrate more on the Clark Kent aspect of the character. And, you know, there's a lot of the newspaper in here. And there's a gossip columnist who may or may not know who Superman is, but she's pretty mean to Clark, you know? She's like, hey, I heard that Lois is gone. Like, the rumor is that she left you for Superman. And of course, like, we know that it's the same character, but most of these people don't know. But I wonder if she knows, right? Because we've seen in Man of Steel, that 6-issue series, we saw some hints of people knowing things and kind of infiltrating the newspaper to try to maybe get closer to Clark and Superman. So I wonder if she's one of these characters as well. But I really loved it. And of course, we get some resolution as to the whole arsonist thing. So Superman was blamed for all these fires that are happening around Metropolis. And as it turns out, he's not responsible, which we already knew, but he's not responsible. Some kid got paid by a secret, mysterious person, a bald guy, as he says, which leads Clark to investigate all his bald villains, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. And I think Bendis shows up in there as one of the villains, so that was pretty cool. Anyways, he's like, yeah, I just, you know, I know you didn't do it. He's like, I got paid $300 by this guy to tell everybody that you did. And so now we need to figure out who this bald guy is. In the meantime, there's some crime element, some crime boss is having a meeting, and we meet a new villain. I think it's new, because I don't remember ever seeing the Red Cloud, but that seemed pretty interesting. I look forward to seeing how that develops and what it has to do with the story. And the ending of the book is a little odd, because we see Lois Lane, by the way, looking beautiful. Patrick Gleason's Lois Lane, holy moly, is gorgeous. She's in an apartment and writing, trying to figure out the title of her book. So it looks like she's writing her book. And so it seems like this takes place at least sometime past the previous Superman issue, because Lois is already back on Earth. But the question is, why has she not gone to Clark and said, hey, Clark, I'm back? Instead, everyone thinks that she left him for Superman. So I thought that thing was interesting. And I wonder if maybe this is not an alternate Lois or alternate Lois, either from, you know, one of the other DC universes, multiverse thing, or just a character pretending to be Lois. I don't know. I think it's pretty interesting, and we'll see where that goes. I look very much forward to seeing where that goes, because I found it a little odd that, you know, if one issue she goes away and the next issue she's back, even though it's two different series. I mean, it's the same writer, right? So the books have a continuity. And, you know, Bendis is great at telling very intricate stories going for the long run. And I think this is one story that will definitely pay off. Action Comics 1001, I thought was absolutely fantastic. I love the fact that I love Superman so much. That's been the case since Rebirth kicked off. And I was a little weary about Bendis taking over, because I thought the previous teams were doing such a good job. But boy, am I sold on this thing. It is well worth it. I can't wait to get more Superman from Bendis. This book is also going to be a 4 out of 5. And of course, that leaves only one book to discuss, and that is another DC title in Doomsday Clock number 6. Written by Jeff Johns, with art by Gary Frank, colors by Brett Anderson, and letters by Rob Lee. And this issue, I thought, might be the best issue of the series so far. It's extremely straightforward, I thought, with some exceptions, and I'll get to that in a second. But the majority of the book, I would say 90% of the book, deals with the marionette and the mime, which of course are characters based on Punch and Judy. And there's some back matter that kind of explains, Jeff Johns explains why he wanted to do this, marionette and mime thing. But basically it tells their origin story. And that story is intertwined into the modern day story. So in the modern day, the Joker has caught Marionette and the Mime, wants to kill him. There's a whole lot of stuff happening. There's like a meeting of supervillains who are arguing about what to do with Batman, who the Joker has captured. And, they kind of fight each other. A couple of them get killed. The comedian shows up and kills some more and they all go fleeing. There's a lot going on here. But I thought what was really interesting was the exploration into the Marionette and Mime. Because I think these are definitely characters that people don't know about. I mean, even the characters are based on Punch and Judy. Nobody knows anything about those characters, right? So they premiered in Captain Atom 85, an issue which I did purchase when Punch and Judy showed up in Tom King's Batman run. And you can probably find it pretty cheap, like, I don't know, 20 bucks or something, 15, 20 bucks. And the characters are a little bit different. A little bit different, but you can see kind of the connection. And of course, all the Watchmen characters are kind of reworks of old Charlton characters. And, you know, Punch and Judy, all Charlton characters. And they kind of got introduced right before, Crisis came out, right before DC absorbed Charlton. So, you know, they showed up in that issue and there really wasn't anything with Punch and Judy for forever until recently. And Jeff Johns explained some of that in the back matter, so I really recommend you read that. But the story was so fascinating, and really it goes all the way back to their childhood. So the Marionette, Erica, I think is her name, she grew up just with her and her dad, and her dad was a puppet maker. He had a toy store, and he made puppets, marionettes, and that's kind of where she got her name. And he sold marionettes of other heroes, so there's like a Night Owl in there, there's like a comedian, they mention a few other ones. And then across the street, a family moves in, an immigrant family, a Hispanic family, and they open a glass shop, and the family has a kid, and he grows up to be the mime. And we learn their whole story, right? So there were crooked cops in the city, and they were, you know, kind of getting protection money from all the stores, and, you know, Marionette's dad would give them the money and would hide it in the marionettes, and they tried to do the same thing with this new family. And the mom was like, no way am I giving you protection money. And they killed her. And that plays a key role. You know, the parent-child relationship plays a key role in the entire issue and really shows the progression of the two characters' relationship as we go on and how that intertwines into the way they react in the present day. And I thought it was just so brilliant the way that it was done. There's a couple pages that are flashback panels about their relationship. And, we see how, like, Marionette and Mime had a kid, and the kid was taken away, presumably, I would think, by the state, because they were criminals. And, you know, Mime was locked up when Marionette gave birth. And they don't have their child now, so I want to know, like, where this child is and who the child is. I'm sure they can go in some interesting directions there. But I thought that stuff was really brilliant, and I really would love to see more of these two characters. You know, they've been kind of key in this Doomsday Clock series. But I kind of would love to see them on their own, right? Like, they're really interesting. Same with Punch and Judy, by the way. You know, when I read that arc, Tom King arc, I was like, why are these characters just don't have a miniseries? Cause they're awesome. And, anyways, I really, really enjoyed Doomsday Clock number 6. Like I said, this may be my favorite of the series so far. And I do have some concerns still about the direction of the book. Because I think when this book was sold to us as readers, it was sold as the Superman versus Dr. Manhattan thing. And they're still mentioning the Superman theory in the book, but we haven't seen that. Like, we haven't even seen Superman yet. And I know there's still 6 issues to this thing, but I mean, we're halfway through the story. So when are we going to get some of that payoff? And how is this connected to Rebirth, right? Because it seems by now that maybe Rebirth is not a thing anymore. And, you know, they've taken the Rebirth thing off the covers of the books. I get all that. But, you know, we were kind of told the story was coming and it hasn't come yet. But I want to see it because it sounded freaking awesome. So we'll see. Overall, I really dug this one. It's going to be a 4 out of 5. I'm back into this book. I think the last couple of issues have really kind of been okay. But this really issue really sold me. And I hope moving forward, we really get deep into the story, and it doesn't just kind of end up being just a story just to tell it. I want the story to mean something and kind of play on that rebirth promise that we were given. So we'll see how that goes. I don't know when the next issue is coming out. I think they're back on schedule, so I guess in a month and a half or two. But I don't even know with this book anymore. There have been so many delays, it's hard to follow. And that's sad, right? I think that's part of the reason people are losing interest, is because this book cannot come out on time. And I don't know what the reasoning is, but they need to fix the schedule on this. All right, that is it for Top of the Pile. Let's do the Comic Predictor segment, in which I talk about some of my picks for this week's new comic book day. And I'm going to kick things off with the one that I'm most excited about, and that is The Seeds, number one. This is from Dark Horse Comics, part of the Burger line of comics that they're doing. This is written by Ann Nesenti. Yes, that Ann Nesenti. With art by David Aja. Hell yes. And this is a, I think, near future, somewhat post-apocalyptic, but not really story, in which people are kind of getting rid of technology and moving to Zone B. A place called Zone B, and there's aliens living on Earth in secret, and they're kind of researching people and experimenting on people, and there's a character who goes to the Zone B and falls in love with one of the aliens. I don't know. There's this seems like a very complex story, but I think one that will pay off. I think it's a 4-issue miniseries, if I'm not mistaken. I saw some preview pages of this. Sweet Jesus! I mean, I love David Aja's work, but this may be his best work to date. And to me, that says a lot, because I think his artwork is just brilliant. And the covers, I think, are all done by him as well. And he's got that very minimalist art design on the covers. They're just beautiful. Definitely looking forward to seeing how this one plays out. Next up, Quantum Age from the book of Black Hammer number 2, also from Dark Horse Comics. This is Jeff Lemire, Wilfredo Torres, and Dave Stewart. And yes, this is part of the Black Hammer universe. I really enjoyed the first issue of this book. I think it was my favorite Black Hammer book so far, is what I said, and I think that's still true. I look forward to seeing how this one plays out, and this is a story in the Black Hammer universe, but set in the far future. There's been some alien invasions and some racial elements here where, you know, people are prejudiced against aliens as a result. Really interesting stuff, and we see future versions of the Black Hammer characters. So, very much looking forward to that one. Over at DC Comics, I've got Adventures of the Super Sons, number 1 of 12. Whew! That's good, though. That's good. I'm glad we have the Super Sons back. This is Peter J. Tomasi, Carlo Barberi, and Dan Mora. And it's a brand new 12-issue series featuring, Damian Wayne as Robin and John Kent as Superboy. And it's a flashback story, so I think this takes place immediately after. It might be pretty close to the end of the Super Sons run that just finished. But it's a 12-issue storytelling, that kind of missing Choco story. And I was kind of sad when they canceled Super Sons, because I really liked it. So I'm glad that we have this new 12-issue series. And this is not part of that Ink line that they're doing. Is Ink the kids one, or is it the young adult? Anyway, the kids line that they're doing. It's not part of that. There will be a Super Sons book as part of that imprint. But I'm glad we have this, and Peter Tomasi, I think, did a fantastic job on that book. So this is, of course, a no-brainer pick for me. Project Superpowers over at Dynamite, issue number 1. Rob Williams, Sergio Davila, and Francesco Mattina. And I talked about the Zero issue, I guess 2 weeks ago. It was like a 10-cent issue. Finally we're getting this miniseries. I think it's a miniseries, in which we get to see some of these Project Superpowers characters, which, if you don't know who they are, they're copyright-free, like, Golden Age characters, right? Characters that don't have a trademark on them. And some of them are pretty interesting. I enjoyed the first issue. It looks like it's going to be a very intricate story, and maybe some time travel, timey-wimey stuff in here as well. I don't know. I really enjoy the Zero issue, so I'm in on this series, whatever it is. Over on Image Comics, I've got Leviathan number 1. This is John Layman and Nick Patara. And here's the synopsis, because it's a layman book, so it's a little quirky. Poor Ryan DeLuca didn't buy enough beer for his party, and while he was out on a beer run, his idiot buddies busted out some mystical arcana and performed a summoning ceremony, a ceremony that summoned the giant monster from hell. Okay, whatever. I mean, this may end up being a little YA, but because it's John Layman, I don't think so. And I think one of the things that Layman does really well is find really quirky stories that at first glance you think would be appealing to a YA audience, but they're not YA books at all. And I think that's really interesting how he's able to do that. So that's why I had to put this one on my list. Over at Marvel, I've got Captain America number 2. This is Ta-Nehisi Coates, Lanil Francis Yu, with covers by Alex Ross. And the first issue of this was brilliant. It is Cap back to form, and it was fantastic. So I had to put this on my list. There weren't that many new number ones. Usually I try to suggest new number ones to pick up, but man, like this is a solid book, folks. You need to be reading Captain America. Infinity Wars number 1 of 6. Jerry Duggan and Mike Diodato. I mean, I like Duggan. I love Diodato. And, you know, the Prime issue that came out had an interesting reveal. So I'm not going to mention it, but I recommend you read it. And this is the new summer event, the new Infinity Wars thing that's out. We've got a new villain, and this is interesting. It's been a long time coming, right? We've had we had the countdown, and then we had all those offshoot miniseries and offshoot one-shots, and then the Prime book. And now we finally have the series. So I have high hopes for this, and I hope that it ends up being an important story for the Marvel Universe as a whole. Brother Nash number 3. This is Bridget Nielsen. This is Bridget Connell, writing and drawing. And of course, Bridget was on the podcast, two months ago. Absolutely awesome. Cool person. And this is from Titan Comics. It is a $5.99 book, but remember, you're getting like 3 issues in 1 with this, and I really like that kind of thing. And I think this book has been terrific all the way through. I think for her first work, it's a really solid series. There were a couple quirks, I think, in the first story of the first issue, but that quickly went away as the story developed. And I think this book has been really interesting so far. There's a lot of mythology and mystical characters. It's described as American Gods meets Preacher and Hellboy, and I could see that. And if you enjoy any of those things, then I think you should give Brother Nash a shot. Again, this is Brother Nash number 3 from Titan Comics. And finally, also from Titan Comics, The Prisoner number 4. This is the final issue. It's a 4-issue miniseries written by Peter Milligan with art by Colin Lorimer. And this is based on the TV show from the mid-60s, I think. I talked about one of the issues, I think issue 2, a couple weeks ago, or a couple months ago, maybe. I don't even know what the time is. What day is it? What year are we in? I don't know. But this series has been absolutely brilliant. It is kind of a mind F and on purpose, because that's kind of the premise of the show. But basically, I don't even know how to describe this book. It's a spy who gets sent to this weird island, and he tries to escape, but things aren't what they seem, and there's a secret society running this island that may have a connection to government conspiracies around the world. I don't know. Lots of really interesting stuff in here. This book has been really strong all the way through. And I highly recommend you pick this up. Again, it's the last issue, so you may not want to, but I'm sure they're going to trade it. And if they're not trading it, then just go ask your shop to get you the single issues. I guarantee you, they'll be worth it. And that's going to be it for this episode of Comic Talk Today. Thank you all for listening. I apologize for the kind of erratic schedule. You know, for a couple of weeks, I was doing great at the 5 days a week thing, but the last couple of weeks, I've been so busy. So, you know, like I always said, when I started this podcast, I promised at least 3 episodes a week, and at least I'm sticking to that. So I will be back tomorrow. I'll be doing the news, and then I've got a couple ideas for some other episodes coming out later on the week. The episode that was going to come out over the weekend will be out probably on Friday. It's going to be a top 5, and something I think you guys will really enjoy. The top 5 segments seem to get a good reaction, so we'll see how that goes. If you want to get in touch with me, Twitter is the best place, @Geekvine. You can, of course, email nerdylegion@gmail.com. If you're listening to this and you haven't subscribed, get on Apple Podcasts or Google Play or TuneIn or Stitcher or whatever and subscribe. And while you're there, tell your friends. And while you're there, leave a review, because reviews help spread the show so more people can listen. Thank you all for listening, though. I'll be back tomorrow, and I'll see you then.